We return to poetry today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today's guest, Clara Caldwell, is here to share some of her mother's poetry with us on Scribble. Your mother was into poetry?
Well, she didn't start really writing poetry until she retired from teaching in 1967. And she joined this was in Pennsylvania, near La Trobe. I mean, she lived in La Trobe, but the name of the poetry society was the Ligonier Valley Poetry Society. So they had to produce a poem each month. They had a deadline, and it was... One time it would be a sonnet, another time it would be some other. Every month it was a different one.
Something like our Quint Cities Poets group. Tell us something about your mother, Clara.
She was born in 1902. She lived until 1997, so she saw a lot of changes in her life. And she graduated from Bucknell University in 1923. She was married in 1928. She was widowed in 1956. But she taught in high school, and she taught many different things, French and math and English. English was her favorite. And she loved poetry.
Yeah, French.
And she moved here when?
She moved here in 1986.
So did she keep writing poetry after she left that poetry group?
She actually wrote only two poems here.
Okay.
She wrote only two poems here.
So almost all the poems she wrote were for that group.
Were for the group, and so I managed to get together, to gather them up. They were all public. They were all just in this series of little pamphlets.
How many were there? Or are there?
You know, I haven't ever actually counted the number of poems that I have. 30 pages in the 30 pages, and maybe two to a page, so maybe 60 poems, 50 probably, about 50 poems, and they aren't really great literature. When I looked at the other poems that were written for this group, they were often a little more lofty in concept or spiritual, but hers related to her everyday life, and so it's like her life is in this whole book.
Well, isn't that better?
for me, it's and the poems really appeal to people. Mm-hmm. So she starts with poems. Well, I rearranged it. I pulled them all out of these little pamphlets and edited them and made them into a book to give to her grandchildren.
Uh-huh.
And then many friends, too. So, and it was just a self-published thing, of course. So.
Well, that's a very thoughtful thing to do. I mean, all I have to leave my grandchildren are a pile of books.
And all the wonderful articles you write for the newspaper.
I think they just... go into oblivion, bottom of birdcages. So
are you carrying on the tradition? I mean, are you writing stuff for your...
Unfortunately, I am not a poet. I don't have that
That's
facility.
Not true, Clara, but but you could.
Well,
this comes from a guy who could but doesn't.
I'm sorry.
Well, but in a way, it's her whole life. She writes about her childhood, playing it in her grandfather's farm when her childhood. She writes. She grieves for her mother who had to leave school at fifth grade because she had to help her mother on the farm. She writes about her father's death, a freakish accident, which is one poem I want to read.
Why don't you read some poems for us?
Okay. Well, when she writes about her childhood, she talks about the childhood going to her grandfather's farm, and she ends with, "Work and sweat for adults, carefree bliss for me." And then she always embraced the new things. She said about the good old days, "When someone sings in praise of bygone years, I do not long for childhood days again. Just now, I do not yearn to tend a fire, to keep the needed kitchen stove aglow, nor do I crave those old-time winter meals without today's fresh vegetables and fruits. And since milk and water were unsafe to drink and modern medicine unknown as yet, I'll take the food, inventions, and even TV, for those good old days don't appeal to me."
That sounds very realistic.
That's right.
Yeah. But you do have many, some older people wishing for the good old days.
Don't you think that's because when you were young, there seemed to be the only conflicts you had maybe were with your parents or inner turmoil, but life was, even with work around the house, life was pretty free. And the younger you got, the freer you were. And I think as we get older, we get closed in by obligations and chores and so on, and relationships get tangled. And yeah, I can see why people wish for the old days, but they don't remember what the old days were.
That's right.
But she did.
Those are an invented old days.
And then here's another one that tells about an old a tradition that we don't always have anymore. It's called an old dry shell. "The candles on the tree were lit. The family gathered round. An uncle handed out the gifts, a doll, a book, a game, a sled. But to one small girl, a walnut shell. Tears welled, then smiles, for from that empty shell there fell a golden locket on a golden chain. Oh, that in life when tears need drying, gold might fall from an old dry shell."
That's interesting. You know, I read about people lighting candles on trees, and I think, were you crazy?
Yes, right. But apparently they did.
They did, yeah.
They did, yeah.
I've never witnessed that, ever. And fake candles on trees.
Right.
But not the real thing. Oh, read more.
Well, then this one is about her father's death in a really freakish accident of mining. And I think anybody today that, I mean, even though this happened in 1920, people still die in mines today. So, "A Wind of Fate. Long, long ago, my father worked with fellow miners stout. The orders that day, take out the posts. This mine is all worked out. By end of day, the pit was cleared. Outside, the men stood round to hear the earth and stones fall in with a thundering, rumbling sound. 'I'm going home,' my father said, and stepped with special care. Just as from out the empty mine came a mighty rush of air. That wind first picked him up, then threw him bodily against an iron wagon wheel. This crushed him fatally. He used to tell of bad cave-ins, of men's by wagons pinned. How strange his life should be snuffed out by an unseen gust of wind."
So, that is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And that's very tellingly put.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go on, Clara.
Yeah.
Well, read more.
Yeah. Well, as I said, lots of times she procrastinated. She's a real procrastinator. And so sometimes things don't fall in like they should. But then she married, and she, even though my father died in 56, and she didn't write this till later. This just shows her love. Your love for me, my dear, is deep as tides upon the sea. As ocean swells edge boats to shore, so your love strengthens me. Your love for me, my dear, is sweet as blossoms pink and white, or purple lilacs near the hedge whose scent pervades the night. Your love for me, my dear, is warm as fires on earth's hearths aglow, or woolly blankets tucked around to ward off winds that blow.
So, now, Tweed, what's wrong with rhyming, huh?
Nothing is wrong with rhyming.
Okay.
In fact, I think, you know, what Claire apologized for, that these are just simple earthy poems, is what makes them great. A lot of contemporary poetry is fairly pretentious and obscure, and the poets seem happy if only about six people in the world can understand them. And we could do a lot worse than go back to this kind of poetry, I think, which reaches people. And I know you've done readings at local
coffee house
things. How has her poetry gone over?
Oh,
because,
they love it.
Because it is, but it's not like the other poetry that I've been to a couple of those, and it's not like the other poetry.
Yeah, some of those are really, you know, they have such angst.
Yeah.
But, and they're giving their angst. But these really appeal to people, and they thank me for it. And they, of course, they laugh lots of times now, that last one about her father.
So why don't you think people write like this anymore?
Maybe they think they're supposed to be fancy and obscure and spill their souls.
Don't you think that when you get loose from the rigors of formal poetry, that it seems as if you have to kind of make it more important, or
right.
You have to do more with it because you're not rhyming, you're not scanning. I want to keep your words here, please, about going back to old Forbes.
Right.
read some more, Claire.
Well, she loved the different seasons, and so in spring she loved dogwood, and so she would ride up to the foothills of the Alleghenies. I took a ride to Donegal as April neared its close to see the wealth of dogwood bloom that follows winter snows. The beauty took my breath away, and this wish came to me. Oh, that I were a bride again to wed neath a dogwood tree.
That is beautiful.
And then for fall, she would write. She did write about summer, but for the fall, she wrote. And this was one that she actually got a prize for. These poems were judged every month, and she actually got a prize for this one. It's called Indian Summer. This year, no sign at all of Jack Frost's autumn call was seen in early fall. Warm sun and gentle breeze put gardeners at their ease, not fearful of a freeze. Each morning one could choose chrysanthemum's bright hues or argyratum's blues. October came and passed, the sun still warm rays cast. Why did such weather last? Yet all is plain as day. Jack Frost had run away.
Very good.
And then this, I'm going to get this one in about Mother Nature because people.
You're doing fine.
Okay. Old Mother Nature, excuse me. Old Mother Nature's moods, how varied. She gives us beauty in the snow, then piles up drifts and ices roads. She sends us flowers to scent the air, but heavy rains to flood the land. Sun, moon, and stars are such delights, yet thunder, lightning, earthquakes, winds terrify and destroy. No, really, this one who gives such ill with good, should she be called a mother?
Well, now there are, you know, there are arguments about this.
Well,
there's a great play, Mrs. McThing, where this little girl's mother appears as a witch, and then later in the play she appears as a beautiful woman, And little girl says, well, sometimes when your mother, when you do bad things, your mother looks bad.
And these are two poems that just appeal to everybody because it's so universal. It always seems to happen so. Perhaps if I'm a minute late to catch the bus, I see it go. When I'm on time, I wait and wait. It always seems to happen so. At noon, I post my check, now due. The mailman's gone far down the row. But usually he comes at 2. It always seems to happen so. To run an errand, I leave home. A friend stops by to say hello. No one comes near when I don't roam. It always seems to happen so.
And that is true.
And then have you ever wanted to buy something that you really like and you go back and it's not there anymore?
Constantly.
This is called Nevermore. The prettiest boot I ever had wore out, as boots are wont to do. The sales clerk looked so very sad. They just don't make them anymore. A tube blew out on my TV. The light switch on my stove broke down. We can't replace those parts, you see. They just don't make them anymore.
I got a house filled with stuff like that.
You know, it was very common for particularly women of your mother's generation to keep journals. And those journals usually talked about the things that your mother is talking about in poetry, what the weather was like, a particular thing she wanted to buy, and so forth. So it seems to me what your mother really has done here is sort of keep a journal, except it's poetry instead of
Did she keep a regular journal?
Yes, often she did. And I want to read one more poem, and then I'll tell you about the
journal.
We're
going to go ahead. Tell us the poem.
Well, this is the one after she moved. This is one that she wrote, one of the two that she wrote after she moved here. We had to pack up her house, 6 rooms, basement, attic. And so when the man from the moving company came, he said, we load your chairs, tables, carpet, and bed, but you need boxes for dishes, towels, you see. For a moderate fee, we sell all kinds, he said. The usual count of 70 to 90 could be. Oh, no, we thought. Too many discards have gone to auction, Goodwill, Friends, and Library. 10 bags of junk left upon the lawn. With speed we packed day after day. One night, would you believe, till almost dawn. Wool blankets, pictures, shoes, all tucked away while we, exhausted packers, still alive, kept stacking box on box in neat array. At last, while waiting for the truck to arrive, we counted boxes. There were 85.
Yeah, I would hate to think of emptying my house.
We're going through it now.
Yeah.
And so this, you ask about if she kept a journal.
Right.
Yes.
She did keep diaries, and then in a box of old toys that I pulled out, somehow I found something that she had written for a week, things that she had done for a week when she went to her brother and her sister-in-law took her to Stone Harbor, New Jersey. And she wrote a wonderful poem there. I don't know if you have time for one more poem.
Yes, read
but
that.
But she talked, in that poem, she talked about walking along the shore, how every day she and her sister-in-law would walk along the shore. It's called The Ocean. I felt the power of the ocean as I walked along the shore of that watery creation. I felt the power of the ocean, buoying beast and ship its mission, feeding fish and man its chore. I felt the power of the ocean as I walked along the shore.
You know, Clara, you've done a wonderful thing in preserving your mother's poems. and particularly in getting them published, self-published, but to hand on to the grandkids. That is a very thoughtful thing to do. And it must give you a whole different and generous view of your mother to go through her poems.
It is. It's like I can hear her every day.
Did she read these to you
No. Once in a while, she would be writing one, and I would come to her. I would be there, and she'd say, "Oh, I have to finish this poem and get it in," and she would be fussing about it a little bit. And no, the only way I read them was through all these pamphlets of the Ligonier Valley Poetry Society, and then I would go through and pick out which were her poems.
Why do you think that was? It seemed to me these are all about your lives.
I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe poetry is kind of...
I don't know if it was personal to her.
Yeah.
It might be that when you actually take the time to write a poem, you're a little hesitant to show it around. Unless you have the obligation of a society.
Yes.
And I think if Roald ever came to Quint City Poets, that obligation would get him to finally move and bring his poetry.
I'll be there. I'll be there one of these Wednesdays.
Yeah, I don't think I'll live long enough. Clara, thank you so much for sharing these with us. It is really delightful.
It was just wonderful to be able to share her poetry. I just love it.
Those are nice poems.
They are. It reminded me of what would happen if Ben Franklin got married a poetess, yeah. Because these are sort of little daily advices that end with a kind of message, but it's never stated as a message.
Uh-huh.
You know, just... And Poor Richard's Almanac, they reminded me of.
You know, when you read a poem and you look at a poem and you think, boy, this is so well done.
Yeah.
And you think of the craft that went into it, but you also think, what moved you to write about this? What moved you to put this down in a lyrical fashion, as if your life somehow became a song?
Yeah, why not just keep a journal rather than turn it into a poem? I realize it's for that group, but still, she's dealing with every day of coming to terms with death and with life and with spring and, mm-hmm. you know, with blueberries. And
well, certainly, Clara loves them, and her audiences, when she reads them, they seem to appreciate them too.
I think I've been at a couple of those coffee houses, and they do, yeah.
I think it is because they rhyme.
Right.
There's something about rhyme, you know, that is the thing that makes it sing or stick in the mind or something. The things I remember from my reading are poetry. Some of the sayings of Shakespeare may not, the memory of them does not rhyme, but the lyricism in the line and the thought is so powerful that they just don't leave me alone. But then I also remember television jingles.
Right.
Something in rhyme that is so appealing. Have you done any good reading lately?
I've done some very good reading, courtesy, as usual, of Don Erickson. A few months ago, he gave me a book called The Wood for the Trees, One Man's Long View of Nature. The author is Richard Forty, F-O-R-T-Y. He's an Englishman. And what he did about 15 years ago is buy a four-acre plot of a woods between London and Oxford, close to the Thames River, that was being divided up. And he just bought 4 acres, not to live on it, but just to have 4 acres of land. And he sets out, he has 12 chapters in his book, one for each month of the year, starting with January He begins with April, actually, the way Chaucer does, and goes through the year talking about the kinds of wildlife, the animals, the insects, and how things operate. But at the same time, in addition to getting a really good naturalist view of the woods, it turns out what you really learn from this book is how interdependent insects are for each other, for the birds. It's just astounding. You know, if what would happen if one brand of insect disappeared? Well, a lot would happen, it turns out. There's one of the great stories in this book is a story of a hole in a tree, in a beech tree, that is made by woodpeckers. They want to get the insects just under the bark. But then when they're through getting the insects, there's a little wound there. And the next year, in comes an insect that is capable of burrowing into it just a little further. And the third year, there is another insect that needs that kind of a thing to enlarge its hole. And now the hole becomes large enough and soft enough from all the insecting around there that the fourth year, in come woodpeckers and make a hole in it so they can raise their family, which would not have happened had it not been for that first little insect that made a hole in the tree.
When you look at the interdependence of life and the world, you realize that if you take something out, the whole thing is dislodged. And I think it was Edward O. Wilson identified 5 insects. He says, you remove them and all of life collapses.
Right.
And you think, wait a minute, 5 insects. And I trust Edward O. Wilson because he is one of the most, not only one of the most lyrical scientists around and thoughtful, but he is very precise in his observations.
But this is just half the book. The other half goes back and traces the history of this 4-acre plot and human involvement, going back to Paleolithic times.
Oh.
How each age determined which trees survived in that woods, why the oak trees survived because people wanted furniture, why the beech trees survived, people needed faggots to start fires, why this tree and why this tree and why this tree. And so you get a whole history of the Norman conquest, of Angles and the Saxons, as they come through this 4-acre plot of woods, all of you, you know, because it's so close to the Thames River. So it's just an astounding book. The wood for the trees, I suppose, comes from the phrase, you can't see the wood for the trees. Well, this piles on more information and history. I learned things about English history that I never learned in the courses I took in college on English history.
It is wonderful when a very perceptive writer enables you to see things you've never seen before. The name of the book and the author once more, just
The Wood for the Trees, One Man's Long View of Nature by Richard Forty.
The Wood for the Trees, is that it?
That's it.
Okay, well, and that's it for now. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thank you very much for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed Clara Caldwell's Mother's Poems today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Scribble.